the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 80 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
Amelia surveys the island for a place to land. Then, she spots the flat section of reef north of the Norwich city. The Electra has landed. Now, they just have to wait for rescue.
For the first time in Chasing Earhart history, we released two episodes of the podcast on the same weekend. Episode 33 of the show is also a Chasing Earhart first, as we welcome back project guests Dr. Tom King and Andrew McKenna of TIGER, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, to recap this past summer's NICU expedition. Among the topics discussed are the unique twist of bringing forensic dogs to NICU, as well as Dr. King's forthcoming second book, and the paper that everyone is talking about by Dr. Richard Jantz. So we want to welcome back both Tom King and Andrew McKenna. It's a pleasure to both have you guys back on the show. Let's start out with a brief synopsis of your individual roles and your responsibilities on this particular trip, NICU 9, this previous summer. Tom, you want to start with that?
Well, I was basically responsible for organizing the group, organizing the trip, and sort of overseeing the research operations. Particularly the land research operations, with Andrew being responsible for overseeing the underwater work.
Gotcha.
There were a lot of other people involved in the oversight and the management of the operation, but I was the guy responsible overall.
Okay. Andrew, what was your role in this particular trip for NICU 9?
Yeah, so for this trip, we had an underwater search component. And there were a number of divers who wanted to participate in that. And so I was essentially in charge of conducting that underwater search for an object that we had hoped to find. There were about five divers among the 55 people, probably more divers, but there were five who wanted to really participate in this particular search. And so my job was to herd those cats and do our best to locate what we were looking for.
Yeah, and we'll get to that particular item a little further in the interview. So it's nice that you brought that up. Now, there's obviously always a goal for each voyage out to NICU. This question really is for both of you, and it might be just playing into your roles in the trip. But what was the overall goal for this particular trip? What did you guys want to accomplish here?
Well, from my standpoint, from the standpoint of the land work, in 2015, Don Johnson, a TIGER board member, had conducted some tests and taken some samples of soil from different areas, including the tops of known graves in the colonial village, and from around the what we call the Big Wren on the Severn site. She'd taken them back, had them exposed them to the sensitive noses of forensic dogs at the Institute for Canine Forensics, and they had alerted on some of them, including some of the samples from around the Big Wren. So the big goal, and the goal that brought National Geographic into the work, mm-hmm. was to deploy the forensic dogs on the Severn site and see if they alerted on specific locations that we could then search,
right,
looking for particularly human bones.
Okay. And now, Andrew, Tom just alluded to this, and we're going to talk about the forensic dogs as much as we can here. But obviously, he had mentioned that you brought National Geographic along. And this is sort of like a brand new approach, I think, to searching the island and kind of really to the hypothesis in general. Can you tell me what you felt or what you thought about that when you first heard that they were going to bring the forensic dogs in, and kind of what your initial thought was going this route?
Well, it was very exciting. And not only for us, but for the Institute of Forensic Canine Forensics and National Geographic. I mean, the whole question of whether or not these types of dogs who are highly specialized in the scent of decomposition could effectively work on a coral atoll island was a big question mark.
Right.
And so it was very exciting to be able to say, okay, we're going to deploy a new technology in essence and see if that works. And of course, working with National Geographic is always exciting because of their reputation and you know, the long history of their magazine. So, you know, over the years, we've deployed many, many different types of technologies. And to some degree, this was just trying another one. You know, we've tried ground penetrating radar and kite borne aerial photography, followed by drones, followed by, you know, we've had magnetometers, we've had side scan sonar, we've had ROVs, we've you know, we're open to trying to use whatever technology seems like it's appropriate and can advance the project. So getting back to your question about the goals, yeah, there are specific goals. Mine was diving, Tom's was on land, but right, essentially the goal of any trip out there is to see if we can advance the project in some shape or fashion. We never really know what that means, but it
right
usually happens in some way.
Now, Tom, speaking of the forensic dogs, how vital were they this go around? They seem to be, I read your report, your recap on Tiger Tracks, that they seem to be sort of the stars of the show this go around. How vital were they for you guys?
Well, I mean, had we not had them, we would have done something else. We would have still gone to the seventh site. We would have searched. But the dogs gave us a focus that we would never have had otherwise. Right. And I really have to credit both Don Johnson for having the foresight to take the samples and figure out and go through the whole work with the Institute for Canine Forensics to show that, yeah, it looked like maybe the dogs could recognize human decomposition products on the island. Yeah. And then Fred Hebert from National Geographic was the one who picked up and said, look, why don't you propose to us that we come in and work with you? So it was really Fred's idea to bring National Geographic in, and that made a tremendous difference.
Now, Tom, there was, we're going to shift gears a little bit here, but there was a, I don't think we talked about this in our inaugural episode with you, but there was a castaway whose partial skeleton was found on then Gardner Island in 1940. We haven't really covered it in either episode, really, but can you take us through the finding, kind of give us a summary of those remains and what they were thought to be originally and kind of that process of identification and where that stands as of right now?
Well, sure. Sometime around the middle of 1940, the colonists, the Ikiribas and Tuvaluan colonists on the island, found a skull or found a cranium, and they buried it. Because yeah, that was, you know, what they did. A few months later, around in about September of that year, the colonial administrator, Gerald Gallagher, arrived on the island and heard about the discovery, went to the site, and found another 12 bones, including the mandible, the lower jaw, several long bones, part of the pelvis, and so on. He speculated that the remains might be those of Amelia Earhart. And there were also some artifacts with them, notably a sextant box, but a number of other artifacts as well.
Right.
So he was directed to do a detailed search, and he did. And he then packed up everything and sent it to Fiji, to the where the headquarters of the Western Pacific High Commission was located. There, at the direction of the High Commissioner, Sir Harry Luke, the bones were examined by Dr. David Hoodless, a medical doctor, then head of the medical school. And Dr. Hoodless, having examined the bones and taken measurements, concluded that they were most likely the remains of an adult European male.
Hmm.
Whereupon there were questions about whether the bones ought to be turned over, whether there ought to be some contact with the Americans, whether they ought to be sent to the anthropology department at the University of Sydney for further examination, and so on.
Right.
And Sir Harry basically said, no, we don't want to spread any rumors. We don't want to make waves. Let's leave it alone. And they did. The bones were basically left in Dr. Hoodless's care. And as of 1941, when World War II broke out in the Pacific, that's where they were. The Tiger in Peter McQuarrie, a historian associated with Tiger, doing research in 1997 in Tarawa, found paperwork about the discovery and shared that with Tiger. Tiger then sent a team, Rick Gillespie and Cam Spading, to England to look at the records of the Western Pacific High Commission. And they found Dr. Hoodless's notes, including his measurements that he had taken on the bones.
Okay.
Those were analyzed, and a paper came out in 1997 that showed, well, that if you took the measurements and ran them through a modern set of forensic anthropological analyses, they looked a lot like the bones of Amelia Earhart. That finding was then challenged in 2015 by a couple of anthropologists in England and Australia. And they said, no, we think that Dr. Hoodless was right in the first place. Mm. There's now been another analysis by Dr. Richard Jantz of the University of Tennessee,
right,
looking at much more detail at the whole, well, all the data about the bones. And he has a paper that will be coming out in a matter of weeks that I think will be very interesting to people, and it'll be available online.
Great.
So that's where we stand.
Yeah, and we're going to have Dr. Jantz on the show, I think, probably within a few weeks or so after that paper drops. So we're excited to have him on the show to discuss that. Now, Andrew, if we can kind of go back to you and kind of discuss your role. Now, were you, this time, obviously, you were the dive team leader for NICU 9. Was this different for you this time, from your past roles and your past expeditions? What can you kind of talk about kind of the difference in the role that you played now versus the role you played in the past?
Yeah. So for this one, since there was a very specific dive objective, and so we were able to use a small team with the intent of searching a fairly small area.
Yeah.
And so, I got the job basically because there were only so many veteran Tiger NICU expedition members.
Yeah.
So, having been one of the few that had been diving there in the past who was going on this trip, it fell to me. And then my diving experience there is a combination of, we did a reef survey in the shallow waters in 2001. And we did a bunch of diving in the lagoon, surveying the northern end where the that sort of delta of sand enters through the passage.
Right.
And then in 2015, we had also done a very deep water, not deep water, I shouldn't say that, a deeper survey on a particular part of the reef where we thought the odds might be good of finding an object that was photographed in 1937.
Yeah.
And hung up. And it was, and that search was, we laid out lanes and we went down to 130 feet and worked our way back up to cover systematically a large area of that part of the reef down to the limits of recreational diving, if you will.
Yeah. Now I know you alluded to it earlier on in the show, but back in 2015, you guys found what was described as a suspicious piece of metal that was lodged in the coral reef, and you went back for it this time, and you weren't unable to locate that metal or that piece of metal. Was this a case of simply just not being able to locate the exact location of the spot or where that metal was, or could it have moved? I mean, it's can you kind of give us an idea of what, you know, the rundown of that piece of metal and what you were trying to achieve with that?
Yeah. So in 2015, Bill Rogers was on that trip, and we were finishing up one of these deeper dives back up to the shell, and we're basically in 15 feet of water doing our safety stop. And he managed to spot an object that had linear, you know, form to it. And when he went over and sort of scratched it with his knife, he realized it was metal. And so it's not in terribly deep water. And it definitely was metallic, and it was heavily cemented into the reef.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, when we went back, you know, you can't take a GPS position underwater.
Right.
We had done what we thought was the best we could do in terms of getting a GPS position, at least for the position of the float that was attached to that area and where we had entered the water from the skiff. I wish I knew the answer to your question. What I think happened is that we essentially, the GPS position that we thought we had just wasn't close enough.
Yeah.
And so we were diving essentially in the wrong place. And I'm not quite sure what the error of that is yet at the moment. But it is also possible that we simply just couldn't recognize it again. I the way it was attached to the reef, I don't think it's moved, so I believe it is still there. You know, we were unable to move it at all. In our first examination of it, and at first it wasn't a suspicious item, really, unfortunately, because this was early on in our survey in 2015. We had a lot of ground to cover, and we knew that several hundred yards away was the wreck of the Norwich City, and this seemed like a piece of cast iron. It had some corrosion to it, just didn't seem like it was aluminum. We kind of checked it out as best we could, and decided not to. It would have taken some effort to remove,
yeah,
a piece of it, and so we continued our survey. We made note of it, and only afterwards did we realize how anomalous it really was, because we didn't find any other metal, essentially, except directly below the Norwich City shipwreck.
Yeah,
you know, 400 or 500 yards away. And, you know, by then the expedition is wrapping up, and you know, it really didn't come out as a topic until, you know, long afterwards. It's like, hey, you know, that thing really was kind of anomalous. And so that's when the goal of going back in 2017 and trying to relocate it became part of that last expedition.
And that remains a obviously a point of interest for Tiger, right? To try to locate that piece and try to investigate it further.
Absolutely. And so the way we're thinking about it now is a combination of things. One is that it's essentially downhill from the object that was photographed in 1937 on the reef.
Right.
And we've investigated the components of the Lockheed Electra, which show that some of the landing gear components and the object, I should say, we believe is consistent with a Lockheed 10 landing gear. So some of these components for the landing gear turn out to be cast aluminum with a high percentage of magnesium. Hmm. And so even though it's aluminum, it would corrode. And we've been told that it might take on the appearance of what we saw, in the sense of oxidizing rather rapidly when you scrape it with your dive knife and things like that. And so the thought is that perhaps this piece that's embedded in the reef is a piece of that landing gear system that was cast aluminum with a high concentration of magnesium. And And there it is. Whatever it is, it's been there a fairly long time. It was securely cemented to the reef. And, you know, even though the reef gets significant weather, I don't think it's likely that it would have moved.
You know, another thing about it is that the algae that are growing on this thing are algae that like aluminum and that apparently don't like cast iron very much. So that's an interesting twist to it.
That is an interesting twist to it. I hadn't heard about that. Wow.
Well, that's what we understand. I mean, none of us are algae experts, but that's...
And we didn't take a sample of the algae, but we've asked a number of marine scientists what they think it might be, given its coloration, etc.
Yeah. Wow. So to be continued on that. All right. So let's segue into the soil testing a little bit. As much as we can talk about that. Tom, can you give our listeners a little bit of exposition on the soil samples gathered and what you guys hope to discover with those samples in a lab setting?
Well, we had hoped that we would find human bones. And we excavated and dug and dug and dug and dug and dug. And we found bones, but they turned out not to be human. And they're under analysis, then we'll see what they are, but they're not human. We know that much. So that was a disappointment. Toward the end of the trip, we said, well, we're not finding any human bones. There's this interesting new research that's been reported, particularly on very ancient cave deposits in Europe, where people have been able to extract DNA from the human DNA from these deposits. Let's take soil samples from the locations where the dogs alerted and analyze them. So that's what we did. And we got the samples back to the U.S., which is something of a challenge. And they are now under analysis at a DNA lab that specializes in this sort of cutting-edge technique of trying to extract DNA from soil. And we're waiting to see. It's a long, complicated process that is still in progress.
Now, Tom, back on our inaugural episode, you had mentioned that this summer's trip was going to be your final one. It was going to be like your swan song out to the island. Now that this one's in the books, can you give us an update on that now? Was this in fact your last trip?
Well, I turned 75 in October. I think I might be good for one more trip if I'm careful, but it's a long shot.
Yeah.
But we'll see if we can get a trip together. There are a lot of parts to bring together to make another expedition happen. If it happens, I would like to go and be involved, but you know, we'll see. I'm getting old.
What do you envision your role is kind of like evolving with Tiger if you decide you don't want to go out to the island anymore, that this was your last trip? How do you see your role sort of evolving with Tiger and especially with the Amelia Earhart case in general?
Well, I'm not altogether sure. I have just signed a contract for a novel that...
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. We'll see how it works out. But it imagines what it would have been like to be Earhart on the island and to die there under the circumstances that we think she experienced. And it's consistent with all our data and all the historical and all the archaeological data, but it is strictly a fictional, it's a work of fiction. So beyond that, I have an obligation as the senior archaeologist, I have an obligation to pull all the data together and do a comprehensive report or make sure a comprehensive report is done.
Right.
And that is something that I am working on slowly but surely, bit by bit. You know, this is all volunteer work and I have to work it in around my other responsibilities. But if nothing else, I see myself participating in pulling together a comprehensive report on the overall work.
Is that fun for you, Tom, to write? Like, I know you signed the contract for the novel to kind of do a work of fiction, but sort of base it off of the archaeological, research that you've done. Is it a fun approach to kind of take a fictional kind of look and stab at kind of what Amelia might have been going through and feeling? I mean, I think that would kind of be a little bit of, that would really be a lot of fun, I think, to do something like that.
Oh, I think it's really the most fun I've had with my pants on. It's really fun to try to put yourself in somebody else's head.
Yeah.
And imagine how that person would react to the situation that he or she was confronted with. And Amelia, of course, as you know as well as anybody, is a fascinating person.
Yeah.
And to I of course had to read a lot of the biographies of her and read a lot of her own writings and try to get a sense of how she would have reacted to being stuck on this island.
Yeah.
And it was an absolutely fascinating enterprise.
But it also would not have been nearly as good if you hadn't spent as much time as you have on Nicomororo.
Agreed. Oh,
that's absolutely true. I mean, the fact that I know precisely what is at X location or Y location and what the crabs are like and what the birds are like and what the weather's like and so on, that made it a whole lot easier.
Now, this is a question I like to get both perspectives on. Tiger's been working Nicu for almost 30 years now. It's 3 decades. It's a long time. You guys have had numerous expeditions, and you've gathered a lot of information due to these trips, including this most current one we're talking about today. And I think I might know the answer to this, but is there anything left for Tiger on Nicu? And if there is, can you both give us your personal thoughts on anything else? I know, Andrew, we mentioned the piece that's stuck in the reef that you guys want to really have interest in. But is there anything else that you want to go back and actually do and accomplish there? Is there any kind of unfinished business on Nicu for Tiger?
Andrew, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. There's unfinished business. People have said, oh, you've been out there 13 times? And you must have searched that entire island by now. And they have no understanding of how big a place it is and how difficult it is to operate there. And the number, if you just add up the days that we've been there, even though we've been out there 12 times, it's not much time.
Yeah.
And every day is full of logistical problems. So the amount of actual time on site working is never enough.
Yeah.
We certainly believe that there are more clues to be found out there, both at the Seven site and on the reef and probably in the village. Yes, it's difficult. It's overlaid with other activities. We're talking about a very tiny little event in the history of Nicomororo. And it's hard to isolate exactly that little event a long time ago, but what we have done, continues to point in the right direction. And just, one example of that is that this past trip, of all the millions of wren trees in the South Pacific that we could have tasked these dogs with investigating, the one that we predicted they would alert on, they alerted on. Do we even know that that tree was where the castaway died? We did not, but now we do. And so each time we go out there, we can fill in yet another interesting piece of the puzzle that we did not have before.
And a couple of things. This time, we found two locations where there are ponds of fresh water, which we didn't know existed. And fresh water that would have been the controlling factor in Amelia's or any castaway's life on the island.
Right.
We now know that there are two freshwater ponds. They're ephemeral ponds, but they do exist for periods of time. So that's a whole sort of new target area that we might want to look at. We found a prehistoric site that we didn't know existed, which has nothing to do with Earhart, but very interesting to know about this particular uninhabited island, that it was inhabited in prehistoric times. Back at the seventh site, I mean, I think the reason we didn't find bones was that we didn't look in a big enough area. The Institute for Canine Forensics was very, very explicit with us that we could not clear very much before the dogs went in, because that would disperse the scent and they wouldn't find things. So we didn't clear very much, and therefore we didn't look at a very big area around the big rent, the wren tree. I suspect that crabs dragged bones off maybe 5 meters, maybe 10 meters, maybe 20 meters, and took them into their burrows. And we've been talking to an expert in crab burrowing activities, who says, yeah, of course they do that sort of thing. They even drag live birds into their burrows and chomp them up.
Wow.
So I would like to get out and clear a large area around the big wren tree and then deploy the dogs, let it settle for a while so the scent gets concentrated again, then deploy the dogs, see if they find, if they alert on new areas, and then excavate those. So, yeah, there's lots more to do.
Hmm. Now, this is another question for both of you. You've both been on, obviously, quite a few expeditions now. Can you give us your thoughts on how these trips have sort of evolved from the early ones to the most current ones, including this one, NICU 9?
Well, let me start, since I was on the first expedition, by saying that, boy, we were really stupid. When we went there the first time, I mean, we had visions of there being a Lockheed Electra standing off in the bush somewhere. Well, and we were going to find it. Yeah, that would have been really a kick. Well, that was absurd. We did not find it. We did find some airplane pieces in the village. And you asked about the village earlier. Andrew mentioned the village. And I think the village is another place where we might seriously find something important, because that's where stuff has been concentrated, where people have brought stuff in. Anyway, we were very, very naive that first time. But we did find some things that led us to refine the hypothesis. We refined it wrong, we think, but we refined it and went back and did further work, and that brought more information, and we refined the hypothesis further and tested it further, and it's been an evolving process all along. But you know, we've, I hope, gotten smarter in the last 30 years about the island and what it's reasonable to expect and what's not reasonable.
Andrew?
Well, I was not on the first expedition. My first expedition was in 2001. I guess the first 10 or 11 expeditions out there always were fairly small groups. The boat we used, we had, I think it was maybe up to 16 team members, plus the ship's crew often helped out. But a small group with usually with some very specific objectives, whether it was, diving or the seven site or whatever it was. But the last expedition was a different animal, in the sense that we collaborated not only with National Geographic, but with a tour operator. And so there were 55 participants. It was a way to get more boots on the ground, if you will. Also tap into the considerable public interest. So these were essentially paying passengers, most of them.
Right.
But they were not, you know, all of them had some reason for wanting to go, other than it was a cruise to an interesting place. I mean, these are predominantly, they were scientists, archaeologists, climate scientists, textbook writers, engineers, people with experience looking for lost aircraft. I mean, they all had an interest and some expertise to contribute.
Right.
And so that proved to be, I think, greatly valuable in many ways, because we'd never really had that many people out there so intent on participating and helping out. And so given that we were only on station for 8 days, having 55 people was useful. We were able to discover things that we would not have otherwise, because we would have been very focused on other things. The discovery of the ephemeral ponds, for example, the freshwater ponds, was as a result of having people who had the ability and the time to go explore a little bit. So it was a very different kind of trip compared to many of the previous ones. And we're talking about trying to organize a similar trip for 2019. The bigger trips present different problems.
Yeah.
When you have 55 people, you have logistics of getting people ashore. You have logistics about different groups wanting to do different things. And so you have to have essentially leaders or staff to manage that. And it does get difficult. The span of control certainly gets stretched, if you will. It's not quite as tightly organized or tightly controlled as the smaller expeditions. We only have 15 people to work with, but by and large, it was an amazing experience. It was full of educational content for the folk. I mean, some of these passengers, even though they were paying passengers, gave lectures on their expertise.
Yeah,
and they were all. Tom gave several lectures on archaeology and the methodology and the sensitivity of working at Nick Muraro and what was expected. So essentially you get an archaeology field school along with a whole bunch of other, keep in mind, we had 5 days from Fiji before we get to Nick Muraro, and then 5 days from Nick Muraro back to Fiji. So there's 10 days of sitting around motoring across the Pacific, and it was a great opportunity to fill that time with some really good content.
How important is that? I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that you had all these different folks that are kind of coming in from sort of an outside perspective that are relative experts in their field and all that good stuff. I mean, how important is that just to the work you guys are doing to kind of bring those outside eyes in there to kind of give you guys a fresh perspective on certain things you might have missed or certain things that you might not have really necessarily paid as much attention to in previous trips?
Oh, it's tremendously important. I mean, for example, with the freshwater ponds, had we seen these ponds, we might have noticed, we might have stuck our fingers in and tasted it and said, "Ooh, that's fresh," or sort of fresh. But we wouldn't have been able to get much beyond that. Well, it happened we had John Atwill, who runs a company that tests water. And he said, "Hey, let me have a couple of a sample of each of these ponds. I'll take them back, have it tested." And he did. And so we have very detailed information on the quality of the water. We've had, in the 2015 expedition, we had a botanist, happened to be my daughter, but she was able to do a botanical survey and look in specifically at, are there any plants here that would have killed Amelia if she ate them?
Right.
The answer is no. And are there any plants here that would have been a source of sustenance? And the answer is yes. And she was able to identify several of them.
Yeah.
We have people with all kinds of expertise. We have Joe Sternelia, Joe is an absolute nut when it comes to finding and analyzing historical artifacts. And he was particularly busy in the Colonial Village this time, locating things that could be associated with Earhart.
Yeah.
And so all these bodies of expertise and interest can be tapped in the kind of expedition that we had in 2015 and 2017. And people came away from it, as far as I could see, quite enthusiastic about the results and the what they got out of it.
Now, I mean, you had mentioned, Tom, earlier about an evolving hypothesis and how that works for you guys. You know, it's been argued by me that a good hypothesis does evolve, and it sort of is like a living, breathing thing that constantly is being reworked and reimagined and kind of challenged along the way. What say you? Is that a fair statement to make?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, in our case, you know, we had the first year when we thought we were going to find an airplane. Once we'd given up that absurd notion, we had this sort of, we had a very vague story about bones being found. So we were very interested in bones. We were pursuing the place where the bones might have been found, but we didn't have much information. As we got more information, we were able to focus in on the seventh site and say, hey, this place meets a number of the sort of criteria for the place where the bones were found. And so that led us to focus on that site. There was one point when we thought, well, let's suppose that she landed on this particular piece of the reef down farther south along what's called Bareki Passage. And let's suppose that the plane then was washed into the lagoon. There will be, then the plane will be in the lagoon, naturally.
Right.
So we went in 1997 and did magnetometer sweeps and metal detector sweeps and divers all over the place in the lagoon, in the location where the thing would have been washed in if it were washed in. Well, there was nothing there.
Right.
So we said, okay, that particular sub-hypothesis isn't right. The plane was not washed into the lagoon. But that doesn't change the overall hypothesis. Now let's think about where the plane and the bodies might be. And that led to other twists and turns. So sure, absolutely. Hypotheses, I think hypotheses have to evolve. They wouldn't be any good if they didn't.
Agreed. Now, Andrew, as someone who sits on the board of Tiger, you obviously have a say of kind of what happens next. So let me ask you this. Do you guys, I know you mentioned you want to go back to the island. Is there other things you guys want to accomplish there? Does this sort of, you know, move into another phase now? You guys have all this data collected that mentioned that we talked about the soil samples and there's all this information you guys have had over the years of excavating Nikumaroro. Does this go into a different phase now? Like what plans does Tiger have to continue their work just overall in the Earhart case, aside from excavating the island and possible return trips out to Nikku?
Well, yeah. So there are a lot of areas that Tiger can be pursuing this. And most of the real discoveries don't happen while we're out there. They happen back here in the States, either through lab analysis or artifact analysis or archival work. Lots of things can be done here in the States. And I would argue that most of our discoveries don't happen out there. They happen here after analysis. Right. You know, just like the DNA work, we didn't know we had anything out there, but it's being analyzed and that discovery is done here. Yeah. And one example is work on the sextant box that was found with the castaway in 1940. And it had certain number combination on it that we think indicates it was once part of the US Navy's inventory during World War I and was surplused after the war. And Fred Noonan was known to carry one of these Brandis sextants. But we've not been able to conclusively associate that particular sextant with the Navy. Somewhere in the Naval archives are the calibration records of the Naval Observatory where these things were calibrated.
Yeah.
And it would be great to be able to find those records and show that in fact this particular box with its combination of numbers was once a US Navy sextant. And so, you know, then the question is, well, okay, it's associated with the castaway. It's a U.S. Navy surplus sextant on a British colonial island in the middle of the Pacific. How did it get there? So you know, that's something that any one of your listeners might be able to help us with in terms of becoming a you know, their own researcher if they have access or knowledge about the naval archives. That's just one thread. There's bottle threads. There's button threads. There's jackknifes. There's all kinds of artifacts that you know, we've done a lot of analysis on, but there are plenty that need further analysis. Finding more bones, obviously, that's something we want to achieve. Finding the embedded object in the reef, that's something we would like to do. Finding more photos of her airplane during the period of its evolution.
Yeah.
Helps understand exactly what equipment was really aboard on the final flight. That work really hadn't been done until recently. There was a lot of confusion about what equipment was on because photos aren't necessarily dated properly, or they are misunderstood. So there's definitely a lot of work that can be done in pulling all these strings together. And you don't necessarily have to be on Nicomororo to do that. But obviously the primary artifacts are, we believe, there. So weaving together this fabric of the story with all the different threads is where we're at. And finding those new threads to that fit.
So, yeah, it makes sense. Tom, yeah. Anything you want to add to that?
Just in terms of artifacts, with what Andrew said about photographs reminded me that we have this issue of what we call Artifact 22V1, which was found in 1991, great big piece of airplane skin, found in the colonial village on the edge of the beach. And Rick Lespie has come up with the idea that it may be the patch that was applied over the lavatory window in Miami before the plane took off. Very interesting idea, because it would account for the fact that its rivet pattern doesn't exactly match anything that we can find in a Lockheed Electra. You can't find it in anything else either. So what is this piece of aluminum? Well, if we had better photographs of the starboard side of the Electra in Miami before it took off, or at some point along the way, that could give us the information that our photo analysis experts need to match up and see whether Artifact 22V1 in fact matches the patch. So there are just a million threads like this that we could pursue.
Now, Tom, I want to segue, we're going to wrap up the interview here a little bit, but there's something I wanted to kind of ask you about, just to kind of get your point of view on. You were recently part of a National Geographic presentation. You and I have talked about off air with Les Kinney and David Jordan, where you guys all sort of got a chance to talk about your work and the individual hypotheses that are being worked, you know, by Tiger and by Nauticos and by the Japanese capture folks. I'm wondering if you can give us a rundown, just a brief summary of that presentation, how you felt it went, and just give us your thoughts on how important those types of discussions are for the Earhart disappearance case overall.
Well, I think it'd be great to have more of those discussions. And it was interesting. I think this was the first time that representatives of the three major hypotheses had actually sat up on a stage together and talked about it. Now, we did not talk with each other about it. And so I couldn't ask Dave Jordan how he accounts for the post-loss radio messages, for example.
Right.
And Les Kinney couldn't ask me how I account for all those eyewitnesses on Saipan.
Right.
It would have been very useful, or it would be very useful, if we could have that kind of discussion without hopefully throwing things at each other. So I think I think that those kind of discussions could be very, very useful, and I hope that there will be some more of them. I was pleased that the one we had here in Washington was, nobody threw anything at each other. Nobody swore at each other. It was a very reasonable, congenial discussion. So, yeah, I think we could certainly use some more.
So it can be done. That is proof, ladies and gentlemen, that it can be done. Okay. anything else that you guys want to kind of convey, or anything we forgot to cover, anything we left out on this most recent summer's trip to NICU? Anything you guys want to say before we wrap up the show?
You're going to talk to Richard Jantz. He's going to have his paper coming out, and I think people are going to find it very, very interesting. It is very technical, but it is it reaches conclusions that are fairly dramatic.
Great. Well, we can't wait for that. Andrew, anything that you want to kind of convey before we wrap up?
Well, I guess one thing I'd like to say is that, your listeners who are interested can participate. Tiger is a membership organization. It costs, at the lowest level, it's $25 to join. It helps support the organization and continue the work. And beyond that, you can get involved as a researcher or an archivist, or all the way up to planning to go on an expedition. Because if the 2019 expedition comes together, it will. While it's not cheap, it will be open to those who have the resources to go and have the interest to want to participate. So, we're not a closed club by any means. And as Tom mentioned before, the diversity of opinion and expertise among the body of folks, applies not just at Nicomororo when you have a larger group, but to Tiger in general, with all the, there's an active forum, and it helps to have as many eyes. It becomes our own peer review network in many respects, and that's very useful for us. So for those interested, there's more that they can get by participating.
Oh boy, I bet that's probably the theme in the Earhart disappearance case. There's more. There's a lot more. So we're just getting started here. I really appreciate you guys, your time and taking the time to talk with us on, both of you have been previous guests on the podcast. So appreciate it. Gentlemen, it's always been a pleasure.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
I'm Chris Williamson, and you've been listening to the Chasing Earhart podcast. You can follow the project on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle @ChasingEarhart. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me tomorrow for part 2 of our doubleheader as we sit down with project guest and author Rebecca Behrens. Thanks for listening.